while I'm speaking with you. They've asked me to wear the mic as well. Okay.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Jim Bolter, and I use he, him pronouns. And I'm coming to you from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, where I'm a professor of chemistry. But I teach primarily in the Department of Public Health and Environmental Studies. And so while I'm a chemist by training, the sort of questions and applications that sort of fascinate me are all related to the health of the environment, the health of humans, and how those intersect with each other. And so our program has degrees in public health and environmental public health, and more recently in environmental studies, but also more recently, in climate and sustainability studies. And so what I'm here to talk to you about today is really sustainability studies. You know, as we move on through the class, the days of the class, we're going to get into a bunch of discussions, and we'll actually do a little bit of that today too. But today, in general, I'm going to spend a little bit more time talking, just so we sort of start with from a common framework, common understanding of what sustainability is. But before I talk to you about what I think sustainability is, I want to ask you all what you think sustainability is. And instead of asking for you for formal definitions of sustainability, instead what I'd like you to consider and maybe talk with some folks around you about are what are some examples, when you think of sustainability, what are the kinds of things that you think about, maybe the actions you think about, or the choices that you think about. So take a moment, turn to folks around you, and maybe just introduce yourselves if you're not already related, and then maybe make some suggestions. And what I'll do is we'll report those out after a minute or so, and we'll see what we find out. So go ahead and do that, please, for just a moment, minute or two. Okay, so let's bring that together and let me hear from you. So maybe you can go ahead and tell me your name and suggest to me what things you talked about as some examples of what sustainability might mean to you. Yeah.
My name is Sulia.
Hi, Sulia.
I was saying that sustainability is taking and buying only what's necessary and then using it until it can't be used anymore.
So maybe I paraphrase as limiting consumption?
Yeah.
Arthur and Sulia's household likes to limit their plastic use.
Ah. Oh. Great. What are some others?
Composting.
Recycling.
Public transportation.
So I'm gonna say alternative modes of transportation. How about that?
With the alternatives, Jill also mentioned energy sources like solar and wind, and she also mentioned nuclear.
So, okay, carbon-free energy. Let's go with carbon-free energy. What else? Any others?
Some kind of limit to growth.
Limits to growth. But there's an important report called that. Yeah. What else? Yes.
Well, I think it should be renewable energy, because firewood is renewable and it's carbon based.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Any others? Yeah.
Chris, we had kind of better use of resources. So like if you're in the brewing process, some breweries will collect water that they use for certain aspects of the process and use it for cleaning later.
Yeah,
I love the brewing example because, for any number of reasons, but also because they're actually really good. There's a lot of good breweries that have done, that have really led the way on sustainability. Yeah.
So theologically, we can think of stewardship of creation.
Stewardship, great. Okay. So Excellent. That's a really great list. So here are some things I thought of and that have come up in classes I've taught before. Buying local produce, maybe eating lower in the food chain, something that happens a lot here at Holden. I'm told there's a list on one of the walls in the hotel there where you can see where our food comes from here, right? Planting trees, reduce, reuse, recycle, right? Maybe this one's getting a little old. Maybe we've already all done this already, and we've moved past changing our light bulbs. Renewable energy, carbon-free energy. No one suggested buying a Tesla. Maybe no one here has done that yet. And bicycling, right? So those are things that we think of sustainability. Now, one thing that I saw a lot of going on here, and certainly I've intentionally kind of selected in the examples I chose, is a lot of these are sort of individual choices and individual actions, right? And so there's going to be, I think one of the really key ideas we're going to talk about as we move forward on this topic is to what degree is a sustainable world achieved through individual actions, and to what degree achieved through societal transformation, right? Renewing, to coin a word, right? If we renew our way of thinking about the world and our relationship. Oops, one more, compost, forgot about compost. How can I forget about compost? If we think about renewing our relationship to the world, what might that look like on a systemic level? So I want to suggest, first of all, as we think about sustainability, I want to encourage us to think in systemic sustainability as opposed to individual sustainability. And one way that people have done that over the years is they've looked at sort of the three primary areas in sustainability. The first, of course, is environmental. And incidentally, did you notice that most of he's here, when we talked about sustainability, in addition to being sort of personal actions, were largely related to environmental actions, right? And so that's what we think. We think of sustainability sometimes. We think of green, right? And that relates to environment. And so that's the first one. And environmental, in this case, I'm going to talk about ecosystem, right? The ecosystem and protecting the ecosystem. On one hand, intrinsically, and look around you. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. It's God's creation, and we love it. And so, but on the other hand, it also provides crucial services necessary for the continuance of humankind, right? We call these ecosystem services, and that ranges from everything from sucking up the carbon dioxide that we spew into it to cleaning our water supply and wetlands and underground aquifers and so forth. So all of these things are one part of sustainability. But when we're talking about whole sustainability, WHOLE, sustainability, we need to make sure that we're also including, very carefully here, social systems. And that would be the social systems that, something like governance systems, and systems that ensure access to civic life and civic participation, right? Effective participation for all, inclusively, and equitable treatment of all people. So social sustainability becomes a part of the system of sustainability. And then finally, the third we think about in terms of sustainability is economic sustainability. Now, sustainability is a weird word because it has a lot of different definitions and a lot of different contexts. And if you go to the homepage of my institution, University of Wisconsin at Eau Claire, and you do a search for sustainability, a lot of it will be like, how do we make sure that we have enough students to keep on paying the bills? And they would consider that sustainability, right? Maybe that's a part of sustainability. It's an important part of sustainability. And increasingly, we're seeing corporations, actually recently, as far back now as the 1990s, we saw the corporate world start to embrace ideas of sustainability. They use a term called the triple bottom line. And the triple bottom line says when we're doing our accounting at the end of the year, we're not just going to pay attention to the dollar signs, but we're also going to pay attention to how we treated our employees and our communities and the impact we had on the environment. And you'll find these, if you're ever curious to know about the corporations that you are giving money to as a consumer, as a participant in society, you can look up things like ESG reports. These are environment, social, and governance reports. And these are actually these are produced for the sake of their shareholders who want to know these things. You can look up CSR reports, which is corporate social responsibility reports. Those really emphasize the social element, but increasingly they're beginning to encompass the environmental too. So the corporate world has sort of decided to participate in the field of sustainability using the term triple bottom line, and you can look for triple bottom line reports too. How we can, you know, there's a lot of ways we can look at this, right? And so we're going to show you just a couple, few ways of looking at this, right? One, we think of the environment and society and the economy, and we say, look, all of these are necessary to have a truly sustainable world. If we have just two of them, right, maybe if the environment is secure and we've got a stable economy, that's viable. But if we've neglected the social element of it, maybe we're just viable and it's not really truly sustainable. If we safeguard social and economic, maybe that's an equitable arrangement, but still not sustainable if we've neglected the environment, right? And so a lot of people use this sort of Venn diagram here, really, to communicate the idea of inclusive sustainability on the triple bottom line. Other people put it like a stool, right? If you don't have all three of these, if you have all three of these, rather, then you can support the seat, which is sustainability. Unfortunately, this sometimes happens. However, more recently, still some time ago, but more recently, people have suggested maybe an idea of strong sustainability because it recognizes that the economy only works for people when it works well within a community, right? If you look at GDP, for example, we'll look at this in the third session, but if you look at GDP, gross domestic product, you'll see that, you know, some countries are doing very well and other countries are doing very poorly. But even amongst the countries that are doing well have a high degree of GDP or per capita GDP, if there's an unequal distribution of that wealth, right? Maybe the economy's doing great, but, you know, in the end of the day, the economy is not a living entity, and maybe we shouldn't affix all of our value to it. So it recognizes that the economy is a subset of the community, and really none of it works if the environment fails us. I think fellow Wisconsinite Gaylord Nelson, Senator Gaylord Nelson, who was the founder of the first Earth Day, said it best here. The economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. All economic activity is dependent upon that environment and its underlying resource base of forests, water, air, soil, and minerals. When the environment is finally forced to file for bankruptcy because its resource base has been polluted, degraded, decapitated, and irrevocably compromised, the economy goes into bankruptcy with it. The economy, after all, is just a subset within the ecological system. So a powerful statement by the founder of Earth Day there. So what we're going to be talking about is a slightly different definition of sustainability, one in which the United Nations has, and we'll touch more about this, but I want to give you an idea about what's going on in sustainability in the global, in global governance, right? And so this dates back all the way to 1972 in Stockholm, Sweden, where there was the UN Conference on the Human Environment, and they produced something called the Stockholm Declaration. I thought this was particularly compelling because this year, in fact, just a month ago, they held Stockholm Plus 50. So in some sense, this is our jubilee here at Holden, right? Because this is 60 years into the life of Holden. In year 10 of Holden Village, the rest of the Earth, the rest of the planet sort of got on board and said, yeah, we can do this, and they met in Sweden, and they produced the Stockholm Declaration. And in it, some of the principles, it's a long document, but they talked about the importance of human rights and turning our back on colonialism, the safeguarding of natural resources and the Earth's capacity to produce renewable resources, the importance of wildlife, and also that non-renewable resources should be shared and not exhausted. So this is a very early declaration of the importance of sustainability in the United Nations. Let's take the focus on a little further, shall we? Instead of the planet or the sort of global governance, let's look at the globe, because that same year, around the same time, 1969, 1968, of course, humans set foot on the moon for the first time. Does anyone know the name of this picture?
Earthrise.
Earthrise. This is NASA's photo, Earthrise, taken by William Anders on December 24th, 1968. And a lot of great things have been said based on this photograph, but here's one that I liked. And this comes from a report we're going to be looking at in just a moment called Our Common Future. And this is from the preamble to the report written by Gro Harlem Brundtland. That's the name we'll see again in a moment. In the middle of the 20th century, we saw a planet from space for the first time. Historians may eventually find that this vision had a greater impact on thought than did the Copernican Revolution of the 16th century, which upset the human self-image by revealing the Earth is not the center of the universe. From space, we see a small and fragile ball dominated not by human activity and edifice, but by a pattern of clouds, oceans, greenery, and soils. Humanity's inability to fit its activities into that pattern is changing planetary systems fundamentally. Many such changes are accompanied by life-threatening hazards. This new reality, from which there is no escape, must be recognized and managed. And so we'll return to this idea of our common future. What's happening at the same time? At the same time that humans are landing on the moon for the first time, the Cuyahoga River in Ohio has caught fire. Now, this is a very famous, who remembers this? Does anyone remember this? Right. This is a very famous historical milestone. But what's disturbing about it, in part, is the fact that this was not the first time that it had caught fire. It actually caught fire many times. It's just that this time, Time Magazine started to document it. And when they interviewed people about the river, it's fantastic, descriptive. The color changes from gray brown to rusty brown as the river proceeds downstream. The entire reach is grossly polluted. One resident described the Cuyahoga as the river that oozes rather than flows, and in which a person does not drown, but decays, right? This is the beginning of the environmental movement in the United States. And again, in 1969, probably less recognized, but equal and certainly in equal importance, was the catastrophic oil spill. And I forget which company it was. Does anyone remember the Santa Barbara oil spill of 1969? So just one of you, right? And this was the first really major oil spill that took place in the contiguous United States, offshore in the contiguous United States, and accumulated on the shore in some places to a depth of 6 inches. And the survival rate for birds was only about 12%. So a huge toll on wildlife and in a very heavily populated area, which is known in part for its great beauty. This really struck a nerve with the American people. But look what happened. The combination of seeing our planet from space for the first time as a species, contrasted with the horrific environmental disasters we were inflicting on the planet. And we have, and it's important to note that all of these were passed. Does anyone know which administration these were? Which Nixon. These are Nixon. These are bipartisan bills. There is as yet no partisan divide over environmentalism or climate. These are the bedrock of the laws still in effect today that make life livable in this country, because it was going in a direction very rapidly that would not have been, right? Many of these, for example, the Clean Air Act has been amended many times since then, has become more and more potent over time, and then others have been threatened on a fairly regular basis, right? And many make life livable for us on a daily basis, and even establish the Environmental Protection Agency. The other thing, of course, that happened, did anyone go to the very first Earth Day teach-ins? Okay, yes. Yeah. Around the same time, and you can actually, it's not a surprise that those landmark legislation followed these environmental disasters, and that this followed these environmental disasters. More than 20 million people participated in the first Earth Day, and it remains the single largest single-day protest in at least American history, remember human history, according to this one source. So an extraordinary thing. We're going to skip ahead now a bit. We're going to skip to the 1980s. And I just have to point out, by the way, that just, I'm going to date myself here just a little bit. This is the year I was born. And so I really feel that in many ways, my life trajectory as an environmental chemist and a climate scientist really has been shaped. The arc of my life was really set at this moment here. And so time goes on and the United Nations moves forward from the Stockholm Declaration and really starts getting more and more into this idea of sustainability. And at some point, the United Nations assemble the World Commission on Environment and Development. And they put together a report called Our Common Future. You just heard a quote from Gro Harlem Brundtland, who was the former environment minister and then later the three-term prime minister of Norway. She actually undertook chairing this committee while she was prime minister of Norway. So certainly multitasking there. And in it, the term sustainable development is first defined as meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. We're going to revisit that definition in a moment and put it in a little bit better context, okay? But before we do, I want to talk about what was going on as this report was being written. In fact, when they first met in October of 1984, and they published the report mere 900 days later, in that period of time, two global-scale disasters occurred. The first one was the horrific accident, careless but horrific accident of a Union Carbide pesticide plant in Bhopal, India, in which over 600,000 people are exposed to deadly chlorinated gases, and estimates of deaths range from 3,800 to as many as 16,000. Wow. The worst industrial disaster of human history, at least for a single incident. This happened in 1984, just after the Brundtland Commission had first convened to define their task. Couple things here that are different from the previous environmental disasters we saw. This had a distinct human toll, mm-hmm. right? And it was occurring internationally. And the news coverage was global, right? And of course, the other one, who could forget, at least those of us who were alive at the time, the Chernobyl nuclear disaster of 1986, when again, the immediate death toll was in the tens of people. The eventual death toll is very hard to discern because the Soviet Union at the time was not particularly forthcoming about such things. But hundreds of thousands of Russians were intentionally exposed to the radiation in a last-ditch effort to prevent a complete explosive meltdown of the core that would have potentially caused thousands and thousands of deaths even across Europe. So the Brundtland Commission does something very special here. They recognize there's this intrinsic link between human health and environmental health, right? And this was new because the United Nations in its short lifetime already had been really focused on development, primarily of the developing world, what we used to call the third world, right? Which was described political goals or economic progress of the developing world. And the environment was something very separate from human emotion or action, right? These were two separate things. In fact, many times they were considered competitive, right? You could help the environment or you could help the economy, but these were exclusive of each other. The new idea in the Brundtland Report is that they cannot and should not be separated. And listen to hear if you hear Gaylord Nelson's words in here. The environment does not exist as a sphere separate from human actions, ambitions, and needs, and attempts to defend it in isolation from human concerns have given the very word environment a connotation of naivety in some political circles. If you've ever been identified as an environmentalist and someone looks at you askance, oh, one of them, right? The word development has also been narrowed by some into a very limited focus along the lines of what poor nations should do to become richer in a very patriarchal manner, right? This is what you all should do to make your lives better from the Western world, largely from the global north aimed at the global south. And thus is, again, automatically dismissed by many in the international arena as being a concern of specialists, those involved in questions of development assistance. But the environment is where we live, and development is what we all do in attempting to improve our lot within that abode. The two are inseparable. Again, the words of Gro Harlem Brundtland, extraordinary leader. So I want you to, we're going to read a quote in just a moment. I'm going to have one of you read it, so I'm going to get the microphone to one of you. And I want you to think about these three questions as you hear this coming quote, not for the previous one, but for the next one, right? In what ways do you hear these words spoken today? Are they current and timely? What phrases or ideas especially stood out to you? So I want you to be listening and maybe pull out a phrase or an idea, especially if it yields an emotional response. And then maybe this idea of inter and intra-generational justice. So first of all, I'd like to ask someone who would be willing to read just a couple screens. It's not a long quote. Would be willing to read that for me. Anyone? Thank you. I'm going to turn this mic on for you, and I'm going to advance the slide. Thank you.
Many present efforts to guard and maintain human progress, to meet human needs, and to realize human ambitions are simply unsustainable in both the rich and poor nations. They draw too heavily, too quickly on already overdrawn environmental resource accounts to be affordable far into the future without bankrupting those accounts. They may show profit on the balance sheets of our generation, but our children will inherit the losses. We borrow environmental capital from future generations with no intent or prospect of repaying. They may damn us for our spendthrift ways, but they can never collect on our debt to them. We act as we do because we can get away with it. Future generations do not vote. They have no political or financial power. They cannot challenge our decisions. But the results of the present profligacy are rapidly closing the options for future generations. Most of today's decision makers will be dead before the planet feels the heavier effects of acid precipitation, global warming, ozone depletion, or widespread desertification and species loss. Most of the young voters of today will still be alive. In the commission's hearings, it was the young, those who have the most to lose, who are the harshest critics of the planet's present management.
Thank you. This is a report published in 1987. Wow. Responses, thoughts. Maybe turn to that person you spoke to earlier and just discuss this briefly for a couple minutes. And if you have a particular question you want to focus on, that's great. You don't have to look at all three. Okay. I feel like I'm interrupting rich conversation, which I always hate to do, but we have so much more to talk about. So would anyone be willing to just to summarize or make a few short comments based on your conversation? I'd love to hear.
Well, Holden Village is a great example. Just when they mine, they just dump the leftovers and move on.
Right. In many ways, Holden Village is the perfect case study of what we're doing here, right? We're using a combination of technology and making decisions about our own actions and behaviors and creating social systems here and economic systems here that are sustainable, right? This is sort of an object lesson in sustainability in many ways. Yeah.
I think those words were current and timely in 87, and now they're too late.
Right. By the way, has anyone been fascinated by the fact that climate change was figured so prominently in that in 1987? Yeah. Right? Oh, yeah. This was a prescient document.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, just we're almost the same age and have kids exactly the same age, and sort of that feeling like, you know, how sort of some guilt about, you know, kind of that emotional guilt about, you know, we heard about it. You know, but we kept living our lives the way we lived them, consuming and living in the world as if everything would last forever.
Yeah. So that pit at the bottom of your stomach sort of feeling, right? Yeah, I totally get that. Yes.
I think as a young person, the whole quote is kind of bittersweet, like that people cared enough to say something and try to do something back in 1987, but just didn't take hold.
Didn't take. It didn't take hold. Yeah, that's That's sort of the tragedy of it all, right? Is that the intent was there, the knowledge was there, but it didn't take hold. It's one of the things we'll be talking about throughout the week. Yeah.
Yeah, and just offsetting that, we were talking about how right now, decades later, the electric cars, they're big, you know, even the American cars, they've got all these cool ads, you know, to really make the electric car push, you know, but it's, I mean, it's nice to see that, but it's several decades too late, you know, yeah. Well, we don't know, I mean, yeah, but it's interesting, they're doing it now.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Sonia.
Hi, Sonia.
I was struck just with our conversation now, how much relationship it has to the previous session that we had on science, mm-hmm. and how we seem to, like 1987, in the 70s, as individuals, we knew. So, you know, many of us as families are recycling, we are we're doing those individual family things. And still, at the corporate level or systems level, we just haven't gotten it right. And I just don't think we as a society understand to the point where the beliefs change our actions individually, but more probably institutionally.
Yeah. I mean, just to respond a little bit to your comment, yeah, I think a lot of scientists have done a lot of real careful inward looking and saying, oh my goodness, what have we done wrong all these years, right? That's the opening cartoon. Maybe if we just tell them the truth, that will help, right? And the climate scientists are falling over, laughing or crying, it's not clear which. Right? Because we learned a lesson that obviously just the model of science is, look, I have this information here, have this information and do the right thing with it is not up to the challenge, right?
One other quick thing, and I don't know, I mean, this isn't solving the problem totally, but I have read that in all the big energy companies, that there are people who are very concerned about the environment who are trying to take over the you know, shareholders and force them into doing things, and I'm not entirely sure how successful they are, but it's been interesting to read about that.
Yeah, the activist shareholder
doing
model.
Just what she's saying wasn't happening, you know.
Right. I'll be honest, this is part of why I left being a pure scientist, right, and moved into environmental studies, sustainability studies, is because one theme we'll talk about here, because this is really dark stuff, right, but the good news is, that we'll come back to, is, right, we know, at least in it, from a technological standpoint, how to fix all of these things. This is not hard. Well, it's hard. But it's scientifically, there's no barriers, right? The barriers are outside of the realms of science. Yeah. And that's why it becomes so important, as we'll touch on in a moment, to think about sustainability from this different lens as opposed to just the scientific challenges. Yes?
I think that's why there's been more focus on communication, because scientists have realized that it's not enough to just say, here's the data. Yeah.
Right. We'll come back to that. We're going to ask the question, why is sustainability so hard at the end of the session here? Okay, one more reading. And here, it's again from the Brundtland Report, which is just a really important formative document. And I'm going to ask you these three questions, again, so you'll have a little discussion here. How does the definition you're about to see, right, differ from the earlier definition of sustainability we discussed? You know, the threefold definition. How is it related? What connections can you find? And does it lead you to consider sustainability differently? Maybe you would talk about it differently, right? I don't think I put that on the slide, but which of these are aspirational? And which of the statements do you think is hardest for you or for other Americans that you can imagine to hear? So we're going to be looking at some statements, and we're going to think, where are our hopes? Where are our fears? And how does this relate to what we saw earlier? I'm going to ask for another reader.
Humanity has the ability to make development sustainable to ensure that it meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. The concept of sustainable development does imply limits, not absolute limits, but limitations imposed by the present state of technology and social organization on environmental resources and by the ability of the biosphere to absorb the effects of human activities. But technology and social organization can be both managed and improved to make way for a new era of economic growth. The Commission believes that widespread poverty is no longer inevitable. Poverty is not only an evil in itself, but sustainable development requires meeting the basic needs of all and extending to all the opportunity to fulfill their aspirations for a better life. A world in which poverty is endemic will always be prone to ecological and other catastrophes. Meeting essential needs requires not only a new era of economic growth for nations in which the majority are poor, but an assurance that those poor get their fair share of the resources required to sustain that growth. Such equity would be aided by political systems that secure effective citizen participation in decision making and by greater democracy in international decision making.
Last one.
Sustainable global development requires that those who are more affluent adopt lifestyles within the planet's ecological means, in their use of energy, for example. Further, rapidly growing populations can increase the pressure on resources and slow any rise in living standards. Thus, sustainable development can only be pursued if population size and growth are in harmony with the changing productive potential of the ecosystem. We do not pretend that the process is easy or straightforward. Painful choices have to be made. Thus, in the final analysis, sustainable development must rest on political will.
Thank you.
Whoa.
So take a moment again, if you would please, and turn to the person next to you again. I'll follow Jeff's example, or someone completely different if you're tired of talking to that person, and see if you can answer some of these questions. And feel free to reflect on the first set of readings as well. Okay, I'm going to do that thing again. I'm going to interrupt these wonderfully rich conversations that I'm hearing around me, partially because I'm selfish and I want to hear some of what you all are talking about. I find this to be true in the classroom at all. I'm really grateful for you all, you, by the way, because in my classroom, when I stop the conversations and ask them to report out, there's silence. And you all tell me what you had a conversation about, so please go ahead and do that. Yes, let's start with you.
I think my answer to 2 and 3 is the same. I think that it's aspirational to hear that climate change and sustainability is not, like, climate change is not inevitable, and sustainability is possible, and it's something that we can do, but it's also hard to hear because that implies that it's true that we're doing it all wrong. And so it's hard to think about the fact that, like, it all rests on political will, and yet that's not something that we're
I think you said that so succinctly and so well. Yeah, absolutely. And not just climate change, right? Even hard things like poverty, right, are not inevitable. Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking, since political will seems to be hard to come up with these days, and you were talking about shareholder activism, so maybe one way to approach it is pressuring corporations to make changes, and then maybe the political will.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent suggestion. And I'm not just saying that because you're my sister. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, actually, if we look around us, I think we've been trained to think of you know, corporations as being, you know, the man, right? The big bad, right? Corporations are the thing to struggle against, but really corporations are way ahead of our governments, mm-hmm. especially our national government, mm-hmm. on issues of sustainability and climate right now. And partially because they're responding to consumer interest and consumer demand. And stockholder, incidentally, right? Shareholder demand as well. So, yeah. Yes, in the back.
So that can be a mixed bag, right? Because Boeing, which we think of as great travel and airplanes and safety, is the number one supplier of war weaponry around the world. Mm. And we don't talk about that often, and they do need to be pressured in a different way than how cheap can my ticket be to New York.
Right, absolutely. And even companies that on one hand, and we're going to be extremely cautious of what we call greenwashing, right? Who's heard that term?
Yeah.
Right? Because someone like, again, you'll see companies like, for example, I don't mean to pick on any one in particular, but Coca-Cola is, just comes to mind, and that's not, I'm not picking on them, right? But they have extraordinary sustainability plans. You go online, you look at their sustainability plans, they're talking about water reduction and whatnot. At the same time, they bottle water in places where we should not be bottling water, right? We have to be cautious when
transparency.
Yeah, transparency is key. Good, excellent. Yeah, other comments.
More sugary drinks.
Yes, that's also true. Right, exactly. So let's bring in the human health component, right? That's sustainability. Absolutely. Thank you for adding that. Yeah. Other thoughts?
Yeah, market forces. Coal is falling out of favor just because it's becoming more expensive than natural gas or solar, or I think just market forces are going to bring about change.
Yeah, that's part of it, but not fast enough, right? So this is where government could be a real help to us. Yes.
So, I suspect maybe we'll come back around to it, but it strikes me that we're dealing with this really directly in the last month with the Supreme Court ruling, and that the political will doesn't matter aside from 9 people or 6 people or 5 people, and yeah. So. The economy had just moved itself beyond what already the Clean Power Plan was asking, which was supposed to be this ambitious goal. And so the economy is, yeah, I don't know. I don't know where it fits in. I don't know where it matters. But
one of the crucial elements of social sustainability is good governance. And I know we in the United States think of ourselves as the birthplace of democracy, but we also all recognize that we have some serious governance challenges right now, right? Even while we do have a participatory democracy, we have some substantial challenges ahead of us in terms of good governance. Yeah.
Something I also heard recently related to coal, I think it was after the Supreme Court overturned, the EPA or the rule.
Yeah.
And you guys probably know this too, if you're reading about, that it was a column about saying that that's not really going to make any difference because the energy companies know that coal is not their future, and so they are not planning for coal. They are planning for not coal, and when they're making their stuff and their plans and this and that, coal is just it's going to be out according to the guy who is following. So
right. Largely true. The Ukraine war, again, peace is a part of sustainability too, right? Has changed that math a little bit, sadly. And we're seeing coal, new lease on some coal plants' lives because of the need to send gas overseas. But that's a much larger issue. Yes.
So this reminds me of something I realized a while ago. Where Jesus says, Sabbath was made for humans, not humans for the Sabbath.
Yes.
Replace Sabbath with economy. That's still true.
I love that. I may use that sometimes. That's lovely. Yeah. True. Yeah.
Oh, just the other thing that struck me was, talking about population control, and that that's such a global. When I think about these issues, I often think about it just as a, North American. And, some of these things, being able to have a sustainable future means we have to move beyond our borders in making it sustainable for people around the world, that we can't have this kind of wealth and inequality in the world.
Right.
That part of the picture. So.
Yeah.
That reminder.
Okay, thank you. I really appreciate all of your comments. We're getting short on time here, so I want to finish up at least this portion, although we still haven't gotten to what I promised, which would be planet. We'll push some of this off till session 2, but I want to follow on a little bit further. So we saw 1972, and in 1992, maybe some of you remember the Rio conference. Who'd ever heard of the Rio conference? At the Rio conference, which was the UN conference on environment and development, see right there, right? There's the echoes of the Brundtland report coming in right there. The Agenda 21. And since some of you have mentioned the talk from earlier this morning that Jeff gave about science communication and going online and finding outrageous things on the internet. If you have ever a strong stomach and you're willing to try it, try Google Agenda 21 Conspiracy. And oh my goodness, what a time you will have. So the Agenda 21 is looked at very askance by people who are fearful of the so-called one world government. But Agenda 21 in reality has a lot of beautiful things in it from which the Sustainable Development Goals really were derived. There was a follow-up in 2002 in Johannesburg, South Africa, the World Summit on Sustainable Development. You see the theme here. And by this time, something called the Millennium Development Goals had come out and been signed by all the member nations, United Nations, in 2000 with a goal of completion by 2015. And then in 2012, Rio Plus 20, the UN Conference on Sustainable Development now, and the report that came out of this called The Future We Want, which is short and quite lovely. Out of all of this came the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. If you're paying attention, you'll see I have this cute little pen here that I got at the United Nations. You see the circle of these. The Millennium Development Goals were only 8 in number, really focused on sort of social issues of poverty and hunger and so forth. And they said, you know, let's go straight to the largest prime number we can think of, 17, and let's, why solve 8 problems in the world when we can solve 17 problems in the world? This is too easy. And so here are the 17, so adopted in 2015, applying to all nations, not just the developing nations. The Millennium Development Goals were really focused on the developing world, the global south, and with a goal of achieving these 17 goals by, 2030. In which we would free all humanity from poverty, ensure a healthy planet for future generations, build peaceful, inclusive societies, and ensure lives of dignity for all. So that aspirational idea, certainly, right? Here they are, and this is what we'll really be using as sort of a touchstone throughout the next sessions. These are the 17 goals. We'll really focus on the first 16. 17th goal is really saying, how do we plug these together, right? And so we'll really focus on the first 16, and I'll let you read those, but we will be spending a lot more time with them in sections as the week progresses.
Could you read them?
Yeah. We see here, it is hard to read. No poverty, zero hunger, good health and well-being, quality education, gender equality, clean water and sanitation, affordable and clean energy, decent work and economic growth, industry, innovation and infrastructure, reduced inequalities, sustainable cities and communities, responsible consumption and production, climate action, life below water, life on land, peace and justice and strong institutions. And on one hand, people look at Agenda 21 and say, oh my God, it's one world government. What are they coming to make us do? Would this be so bad?
Sorry, what year was that?
It was agreed to in 2015 with a goal of 2030. Ambitious, right? Right, and you can break these into several ways. We'll be breaking them into these three, this little wedding cake structure here, in which we look at goals 6, which is the drinking water, climate action, life on water and life on land as sort of the biosphere. We're looking at the sort of society ones. That's what we're really focusing on tomorrow, although it looks like we're going to have to review biosphere as well because I took too long. I always try to put in too much. And then we'll end with economy. And you'll notice, again, like strong sustainability, the biosphere is the foundation. Society rests on a healthy biosphere, and economy arises out of a healthy society. So why don't we do sustainability well as a society? Why is it so hard for us? I was going to have you all talk about this, but in the interest of time, I'm just going to tell you some things that I think make sustainability difficult.
Sin.
Ah, the theologian speaks. Sin, right? But more specific than that, because we're going to come to that too. The time frame is intergenerational focus, right? We look at the future generations who are paying a disproportionate price of our actions today and the actions of our forebears, right? So it, 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 challenges because we think in short term. We think about, in companies, we think about this year's financial reports to our shareholders. If it's political, if you're in the House of Representatives, it's 2 years. And if you're in the Senate, it's 6 years. And all of these short term time horizons make sustainability hard. We'll talk about discounting future values in the economics thing on Friday. Geography, right? It's the intra-generational focus means we have to think about people who aren't our neighbors. And when I say our neighbors, I don't mean neighbors in a theological sense in which all of the world is our neighbors, but I think the people that are immediately surrounding us and in contact with us. We have to think about people who are unrelated to us and unknown with us that we may never interact with. The scales are challenging because it's not just thinking about the individual or the community. We have to think more beyond the nation to transnational priorities, and this is what makes people break out in a cold sweat. And it's also interdisciplinary, because we can no longer say, I'm a chemist, and I know how to solve this problem, and I'm going to solve that problem, put that Band-Aid on it, and at least I've solved my part of the problem. But we recognize that these are all so strongly interdependent that we can no longer solve just one part of the problem. We have to think more holistically. We have to think about economic, social, and environmental considerations when we make all sorts of policy decisions. We can't just solve economic problems, and we can't just solve environmental problems as much as I would like to as an environmentalist. And this is hard because the way we are organized, if we think about how we're educated and how we're divided, we divide ourselves into nations, into cities. I hate Denver because they have the Broncos, right? Social class, absolutely. Even in schools, we have majors, right? And so we become experts in a small, and so we think of all these divisions, and they make it really hard to do this. So, absolutely, inequality of power, privilege, and wealth, values, customs, and traditions, differences between values, customs, and traditions, especially around the world, but even right between scientists and non-scientists in terms of struggling with our communication, levels of education, available technology, patterns of consumption, and population. These are the underlying challenges. Equity becomes absolutely crucial. Who decides? Who benefits? Who is burdened? Who is blamed, and who is responsible? And these are all different parties a lot of times, right? For good or ill. And then finally, it's this idea of complex and interconnected human ecological challenges. It's not just an ecosystem, it's not just an economic system or a social system, it's these interconnected systems that requires us to think in systems, but also across systems. That sounds exhausting. How, if we can't solve one simple thing like climate change, how can we possibly solve climate change and poverty and hunger at the same time? And education and gender disparities? How can we do that? I return to a quote by Dwight D. Eisenhower, President Eisenhower. When you have a difficult problem, don't narrow it down and solve a smaller problem. Instead, Eisenhower said, and this is the person who planned D-Day, right? He said, whenever I run into a problem I can't solve, I always make it bigger. I can never solve it by trying to make it smaller, but if I make it big enough, I can begin to see the outlines of a solution. So maybe that is the core, the nucleus of our answer to how we start to tackle these intractable problems, is we start thinking about them as a whole. We think about food systems, but we realize that food systems are connected to economic systems, and all of these are connected to energy systems and water systems. And wow, I've just named four SDGs for one issue, and I didn't even have to think about it, right? So this is really what we're going to be doing for the next 3 days now, although on the last day on Friday, we will have an opportunity to get in some small groups and think about ways that we can return, right? We can bring this home to our families, our communities, and our contexts outside of the lovely sustainable village we call Holden. So thank you for giving me an extra 2 minutes of your time. I'd love to have any questions, and if those of you who are rushed to get to dinner may do so, and I'll be happy to field questions for however long you all want to stay in this room, that'd be cool too. So yes.
Just briefly on the education piece, being a UW-Eau Claire grad and thinking about the emphasis when I was there.
I forgot that. Thank you for reminding me. That's awesome.
Liberal arts education. Yeah. Who takes your classes?
Who takes my classes? I'm I have difficulty focusing on one thing at a time, as you may have guessed, right? So half of my time is split between teaching chemistry majors and in chemistry classes, and then I teach classes in environmental public health. I'm designing a climate and public health course now for our brand new master's in public health degree that we're planning right now. And I also teach first-year students in E&V 101, which is an introduction to sustainability class, so I'm literally all over the map, just about everybody.
Great.
And this stuff, one way or another, finds it into almost all of my classes, I'm afraid to say. Yes.
So a couple of the quotes said things, at least I thought I read, without anybody losing their current standard of living. And I'm thinking... maybe not.
Actually,
and not just Jeff Bezos, probably me too.
Oops, wrong way. Yeah. In the second.
Yeah.
And you were doing the reading, so it's harder to pay attention when you're actually doing the reading. And
right
so
there.
I would say, assurance that those poor get their fair share of the resources required to sustain that growth. Such equity would be aided by. So it's in code, right? But there is the sense that...
Go back two slides. It's
yeah,
right
I think
there
it was two slides,
red.
Wasn't it?
Right there, in the red, without compromise.
Yeah, so to meet their own needs, right? But there is the sense that we do need to have, in other places, the Brundtland document, the Brundtland report as well, there is a sense that we need to somehow balance access to resources in a way that's not currently the state, the case, right? So maybe I didn't choose all the brief excerpts there that demonstrate that. But, well, here, an assurance that those poor get their fair share of the resources required to sustain that growth, right? And this idea of equity does imply, maybe not super strong, but an idea of somehow rebalancing access to capital and resources, I think.
It's
the corporation who will never be.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, right now, in our political state, climate change and sustainability is a very political issue, and there's often divide when it comes to like sides of the equation. But at the time when this was written up, you kind of implied that it wasn't as big of a political thing. Was it like, was this a debate between distinct sides or anything like that?
Yeah, it's fascinating to look back just on the issue of climate change, which is sort of my personal strong suit. You know, as recently as 2006 or so, there was a really famous commercial of Newt Gingrich and Nancy Pelosi sitting on a park bench together talking about how climate change was of importance to both of them. And it wasn't until 2009 when a really important, the Waxman-Markey cap and trade bill went to Congress and very nearly passed. It passed the Senate, I think, and it languished in the House. Or did I have that backwards?
It's backwards, yeah.
Backwards. It passed the House and languished in the Senate, right? Echoes of the past. So that was the point at which the partisan divide, at least on climate change, became seemingly irrevocable, right? But even now I teach at a state school, so I'm very careful how I talk about issues related to partisanship. But I will say, while folks who were opposed to action on climate used to argue that climate change wasn't happening, right? That argument is all but faded into obscurity. Now the argument is, well, either A, it's too late. Oh, that was self-serving. Or we just need to adapt, right? We need to do it through adaptation rather than preventing additional damage to the climate system. So it's interesting to see how the argument has shifted even amongst those who are opposed to action on climate. And is that hopeful? They're getting closer, right? Are we seeing any legitimate bills come from that side of the aisle? And here I'm just going to go around, I'm just going to dive into partisanship, right? Just recently in the House of Representatives, the conservatives came up with their climate plan, their climate action plan, which was basically an all the above energy strategy in which we need to use domestically produced fossil fuels more effectively. And that was a bit shocking. So we still have a long ways to go. But it wasn't always partisan. And the environment, more generally, the environment was in the 1970s, was not particularly partisan.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is the House Climate Caucus, which
yes.
has 60 people or something, which needs to match one for one, and the latest infrastructure stuff with Build Back Better, clearly the main problem that we point to is Joe Manchin, a Democrat.
Right, that's true, yeah. And as much ire as I direct at Joe Manchin internally, it's important to recognize that there are 50 other senators that could very easily step up and take his place.
Which goes to the short-term politics and giving Biden a win. And
right, exactly, yeah. It's all that short-termism, right, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
So the population aspect of this, I was thinking about the how generally speaking, at least folks of my generation and maybe younger now, the population, like the birth rate is going down.
Yes.
And typically speaking, economists say that that's a bad thing because right. then you don't have as many workers in the future. Is there aspects of this plan that are going to, like, that they've talked about this?
I'm going to push that question off until Friday, sorry. Because I don't have a really, mostly because I don't have a good answer for you right now. Because this plan is... we're going to talk through, so each of those goals, right, have multiple targets, in some cases as many as 13 or 14 targets, and then each target has as many as maybe a dozen or so indicators. So in the end, there are hundreds and hundreds of data streams. So this is actually all done in a semi-quantitative, in some cases.